Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green, and, you know, this is an election year, and it's really easy to get caught up in the horse race and the politics. We're going to spend a nice bit of the show talking about, some serious, deep policy questions, foreign policy, immigration policy. Okay, then we'll get to Taylor Swift, I promise. But let's start with foreign policy. President Biden says he has made a decision about how the United States is going to respond after three American service members were killed in Jordan by an Iran-backed militia. We're not getting much more from Biden or the White House than that, though the president did say we don't need a wider war, but he's not being specific yet, telling us what his plans are. Iran-backed militias have been targeting U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria since the war between Israel and Hamas broke out. But this new attack in Jordan is the first to kill American service members. Let's listen to Sabrina Singh. She's the deputy Pentagon press secretary.
And I'm not going to get ahead of the president. I'm not going to get ahead of any decisions that have been made. What I can tell you is the groups that are conducting these attacks, we know have Iran behind them. They have the support of Iran. They are trained and equipped by Iran, but they are operating within Iraq and Syria. They are attacking our forces there. And of course, tragically in Jordan. So again, the president is going to take all necessary means that he feels to protect our forces, to protect American interests. But I'm not going to get ahead of what military action looks like.
Okay, Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy are here as always. I want to ask you both. We've been talking for years about this threat from Iran and how the United States should respond. We heard all the debates over whether an Iran nuclear deal was smart, was not. Did it make us more likely to go to war with Iran or less likely? I just want to help our listeners understand and think through, given all that context, what's at stake right now. And I don't want to over-dramatize it, but feels like we're at an incredibly tense and pivotal moment here with Iran. Do you both see it that way?
I think it is a very tense and pivotal moment. And I think Iran is trying to take advantage of it. Look, I think there are two schools of thought on this. One, Iran wants to tread somewhat carefully because it doesn't want to get drawn into a full-scale kinetic conflict with the United States, but that it also wants to use the unrest in the region as an opportunity to assert itself. It has always wanted to be the superpower regionally, and so they want to use this unrest as an opportunity to assert themselves without drawing the United States in too deep. The other school of thought, and I'm not sure these two things are completely mutually exclusive, the other school of thought is that Iran wants to absolutely conflate their own efforts with the war in Israel and Gaza. That, just this week, there was a protest, anti-war protest in Washington, D.C., in front of the Holocaust Museum, with protesters holding up signs that said, hands off Yemen. The fact that Iran is beginning to gain some headway in conflating, making people think that their own efforts are just part of that because they know how divisive the conflict in Israel and Gaza is amongst the American people, that they're maybe going to try to take a few extra liberties because they think they can get away with it in the context of creating political instability in the U.S. So whichever school of thought you're in, I think the fundamental is Iran has been looking for years for an opportunity to become and assert itself as a regional superpower, put itself on that global stage. And they're testing us. How far do we go in preventing them? I think the United States is going to assert itself just short of a full-scale war. But it seems like they're testing us right now to see just how far we are going to go.
Sarah, before you jump in, I just want to underscore something you said, Mo. I mean, I hear you saying that Iran is very aware of our domestic politics, and you know they're supporting the Houthis in Yemen, who have been attacking all of these trade interests in the Red Sea. President Biden has decided to target those Iran-backed Houthis, and the response in the United States among some of Biden's own supporters, a lot of progressives who don't want to see military action, you know, in a lot of places in the world, are basically almost sympathizing with an Iran-backed militia, but also civilians in Yemen and saying hands off Yemen, which puts the president in an incredibly difficult spot.
Yeah, though I do think this is a little bit different in that American service members were killed as a result of these attacks.
And so while they're going to be
in Jordan. So I think, you know, even though you're seeing some protests out there, and Iran, along with Russia and China, love to stoke division and take advantage of our hyperpolarization, I do think it is a little bit different because American troops were killed. But look, you know, there are reports this week that the United States is back channeling to Iran, like get your people under control, get the Houthis under control, because if they keep doing this, we are going to respond in a way you're not going to like. And there are some reports that Iran is actually starting to get a little nervous about that. While they are funding and supporting the Houthis are not necessarily like a well-oiled machine and are going to kind of do their own thing, even with Iran's backing. So there are some reports that Iran is getting nervous. If that's the case, then the United States needs to keep sending those messages. The Biden administration needs to keep sending those messages. But if Iran is really willing to play with fire on this, it's going to be risky.
Sarah?
Here's the problem. You have a post-World War II world order where America is the singular superpower, especially in a post-Cold War setting. And in order to do that, America has to project, it's peace through strength, right? It's the idea that you mess with us, you mess with our friends, we'll obliterate you. Nobody believes that's true anymore. Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, these are not isolated. You know, we can talk about Iran and the Houthis, individually because there's uniqueness to each situation, but it's coming from this overall problem. And, you know, I think that the Obama red line in Syria that they then didn't stick by matters a lot. But again, it's in this larger context of America being unwilling to meet that obligation of being the world superpower. The American public is not behind it. And Iran knows we're not willing to go to war with them, which is why they're going to call our bluff at every step of the way of this, as is China when it comes to Taiwan. We already saw Russia and Ukraine. We're seeing it to a different extent in Israel as well. So, you know, I think that that's a bit of a problem.
So what do you think President Biden has to do in order to reestablish the United States as a superpower who doesn't accept countries like Iran from messing with it? I mean, do you think he needs to go to war and take really radical action?
Well, that's the bummer, or the beauty of peace through strength. The beauty of peace through strength is that, you know, you look at the civilian deaths, for instance, in the 20th century, it's gone down dramatically as the United States has become that singular superpower, because everyone knows how it would end for them. So therefore nobody starts nothing. Well, now that we've lost that credibility and nobody thinks that the American people are actually willing to use that strength, that's why the peace goes away. So you've got to convince these countries that America absolutely has the will to be that singular superpower. But why should they believe that when we don't believe it?
But again, what do you do if you're Biden in this moment? I mean, there are a lot of Republicans who are saying, like, you need to, you know, I mean, John Cornyn said target Tehran, and then he sort of took that back. But I mean, that's the kind of pressure that Biden's under from Republicans, I think.
What has happened previously is that we would tell Iran where we're going to target to ensure that all civilians are removed, that they can take out anything particularly valuable, and then we hit those targets so that we knock down their communications. You know, it's, you know, a quote-unquote proportional response. Whereas, again, that's not peace through strength. That's not really how that works. You kill three American service members, the wrath of God falls down on your head and your country. But again, Iran doesn't think we're going to do that. Joe Biden doesn't think we're going to do that.
But the question is, how far do they go against Iran? Look, the United States, the administration is not being coy in laying the blame at the feet of Tehran, right? Like, you heard the defense secretary this week in his first big public appearance since returning from his absence due to surgery. He came out this week and said, look, every indication is that this is connected to Iran. And, you know, I think he said something along the lines of, look, they've got a lot of resources. I have more, right? We're beginning, I think, to send that message that if this does not stop, if there is any further escalation, expect the wrath of God from us. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to wait. I think we will see some sort of military response. And I think it will be more pointed than just targeting some Houthi outposts in Lord knows where. But to go into Tehran, as some Republicans are talking about, and to launch a massive escalation into Iran might actually be what draws us into a deeper war that I suspect a lot of Republicans will regret us being in if it comes to that. And look,
but to be clear, Mo, by the way, just to agree with you, like violently agree with you. But, you know, when I'm talking about undermining peace through strength and how hard it is to then get that credibility back, I'm talking about Republicans who don't want to fund arms to Ukraine as well.
That was going to be my point. Yeah.
Everyone has blame here. And more importantly, the American people who, I get it, but do not want to actually do any of this. They don't want to be the world's police anymore. Well, guess what happens if you're not the world's police?
Can we adjust? Yeah. Can we adjust to not being the world's police? Is that an option to get away from the you mess with us and
sure,
we'll
if you
obliterate
want a really,
strategy?
Really dangerous, unstable world where other countries then fill in that role. China is already doing it in Africa, in South America. Iran will now be the regional power in the Middle East, which will not be great for some of those other countries in the Middle East that really enjoy some of the peace and economic prosperity that they've had. Russia will take Ukraine and maybe some other countries. I mean, yeah, if America wants to withdraw, it absolutely can, and it will be a very, very dangerous 21st century.
This violent agreement, I'm fascinated by the way you two are violently agreeing because I hadn't thought about this. You have Republicans saying, don't fund the conflict in Ukraine, which people like Joe Biden are saying, well, that's going to let Russia grow in power. You have Republicans saying, you better do something about Iran, and there's not a will among the American people to go into a wider war. Like, do we need to accept that the American people don't want us to be that superpower that the three of us are saying has always been the U.S. role for decades now?
I'm not sure Americans are okay with the trade-off.
Yeah,
they don't
want to
be the
world
superpower. They don't want to be the world police, but they want all the benefits of it, right? They think that the world will just stay peaceful and everyone will still respect the United States and not go taking their neighbors, land and killing civilians recklessly. They don't want to see that, but they're not willing to do what it takes.
That's right. They don't want to play that role until they do. And that's what we're barreling towards right now. And, you know,
and it'll cost a lot more lives and a lot more money when we come in late to the game versus having the peace through strength fear on the front end.
And this is why our politics right now are so damaging to our credibility, because I agree with Sarah to an extent. I think what Iran is doing is not looking at our lack of will in Syria, though I do think that was maybe one of the biggest failures of the Obama administration, was how, you know, that red line. But they are looking at it. They are looking at Ukraine, and they are looking at our will and our resolve there. And they see how our domestic politics is crippling us, even when there is a will from an American president. Our domestic politics are not allowing us to engage even monetarily, let alone militarily. Not that there's a huge interest in escalating it militarily using boots on the ground, American boots on the ground. But if we're not even willing to put money behind our allies in Ukraine, suddenly people look at us very, very differently. China is watching this vis-a-vis Taiwan, and Iran is watching this vis-a-vis what's happening in Israel and Gaza, and they are taking advantage of it. China is watching our response to Iran as much as anything else.
All right, we'll stop there and take a break. And Mo and Sarah and I are going to come back and talk about who controls the United States southern border. You are listening to Left, Right, and Center. All right, welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, your host. Mo Lathy's here, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. Sarah Isger is here. She's Senior Editor at The Dispatch. And there is going to be some kind of protest this weekend in Eagle Pass, Texas. Many people in that community along the U.S.-Mexico border are angry. They're feeling that the migrant crossings have gotten out of control, putting a strain on local towns and cities and putting residents at risk. People want to send a message that they trust their Republican governor, Greg Abbott, to deal with this more than the Biden administration. Abbott's Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick was speaking on local Fox 4.
Along the border in Eagle Pass, it appears Texas is in charge, and some want it to stay that way.
Mr. President, you say you want to secure the border. Texas has secured it. Leave it alone. We don't need you down here.
Now, one local Democratic leader in Maverick County, where Eagle Pass is located, repeated something that we hear from many other Democrats, that Republicans are exaggerating the immigration challenge.
Maverick County Democratic Party Chair Juanita Martinez says the scene shows the dysfunction between Texas's governor and the federal government.
I said, safety from what? All this is just a political stunt by Abbott to make people scared. And oh my gosh, why? Because the Republicans don't have anything else to run on.
Armed guards and state police occupy the park, which Republican Governor Greg Abbott says is necessary to enforce the state's own border security program called Operation Lone Star.
Okay, that was from Fox 26 in Houston. Now, as part of our 50 States series, we are going to go to the state of Texas. We're taking a look at stories from one state to the next to really get a sense of what's happening in our country from the ground up to see what we can learn in this election year. And this week, Texas and the question of who is in charge. Texas officials put up razor wire fencing to try and block the border in places like Eagle Pass. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled recently that the federal government has the right to remove that stuff, arguing that the razor wire and fencing prevented federal border patrol from accessing those areas. Now, Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the federal government has abandoned its duty to protect the southern border. Abbott said Texas would continue to exercise its right to secure our southern border. So, Sarah, let me start with you. Where does this leave us? Because the Supreme Court weighed in, but judging by what we're seeing and hearing at the border, it doesn't sound like people have just accepted that the federal government is in charge, call it a day, and move on. This is very active.
No, and that's not what the Supreme Court said
what
either.
Help us understand exactly.
The Supreme Court was very narrow. It was whether the federal government had the right to cut through that concertina wire. The Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said yes. Now, bear in mind, what we have here are, this is Texas land and Texas putting up wire on that land. And it's also the U.S. border, and the federal government is in charge of immigration. It's in Article 1, Section 8. So really, the Supreme Court's decision was very narrow. There will be another case on the merits moving up that decides whether Texas has the right to put up that concertina wire in the first place, for instance.
You're saying they didn't decide in this case that the federal government is in charge. They just said narrowly, like, you can cut that wire if you need to. Okay.
That's right. And Texas can put it back up afterward if you want.
Yeah, they didn't say that Texas can't put it up, right? That was not part of the ruling.
Correct. So, like, this idea that Texas is somehow ignoring the Supreme Court or, thumbing its nose, like, there's literally nothing Texas can do to not obey this Supreme Court order because it had nothing to do with Texas. It was actually just about the rights of the federal government.
Sarah, do you think there's a reason for that razor wire and barriers, or is some of this political ploy?
Look, it is very clear that our immigration laws are broken, and the only one who can fix that is Congress, not the president. Are there things that President Biden could be doing differently? Yes, they would be Band-Aids on a sucking chest wound at the southern border. But yeah, there's Band-Aids that he could be using. At the same time, does the concertina wire between ports of entry slow the flow of people coming across the border illegally into Texas? Yes, it also does that. But until you change the fundamentals, and there's two, there's the enforcement side. You've got to have, I mean, we're not talking small increases in enforcement. We're talking tens of billions of dollars on detention facilities, immigration judges, CBP officers, all of it on the enforcement side that can only come from Congress, and changing our asylum laws. Because right now, if you cross the border illegally, and then the first person you see, you say, I have a credible fear of returning to my home country, you now didn't commit a crime according to our laws that make a lot of sense when you think of it in a post-World War II America, where America was ashamed of what it did, turning away Jews during the Holocaust. So in 1980, they passed this asylum law. That is creating these incentives. If you don't change the incentives for the cartels that are making billions of dollars trafficking humans to the border at $10,000 a pop, then yeah, you may slow the flow of people coming in. There's things Biden could be doing to be slowing it. The Texas concertina wire will slow it. But unless you change the business model for those cartels, you will not change the crisis.
So I want to disagree on one thing you said, Sarah, which is that there's nothing Texas could do to be non-compliant with this. Look, the federal government, Supreme Court ruled the federal government has a right to cut down this wire if it chooses to do that, which means they have to have access to it. And the fact that the Texas National Guard is being mobilized to block the Border Patrol from gaining access to this land, and Donald Trump is now mobilizing other governors, urging other governors to send their National Guard down, right? That is, I think, a real problem and where this comes to a head. So I do hope the Supreme Court weighs in on the bigger issue at some point, because right now we're seeing a dangerous standoff between the Texas National Guard and the United States Border Patrol, which is just not anything we should, any of us should want to see. Your bigger point, I agree with. Congress, get off your hinies and get to work. Like this, we have to get a legislative fix to this. There has not been a ton of political incentive under Democratic or Republican administrations, as we have talked about time and time again. And Sarah and I are in complete agreement that both Democratic and Republican presidents have fallen short on this issue. And that's why this is frustrating. This specific moment in time is so frustrating because for whatever reason you want to attribute it, we actually have an opportunity to pass something that would be one of the most consequential border security bills we have seen in recent times. I'm going to say, I don't love this bill, and there are going to be a lot of people on the other side who don't love it either because they don't think it goes far enough.
But it's a compromise.
Something.
It was
but
getting
it
close.
It's a compromise, and it is something.
And the Republicans caved to Trump. And now
one
those
side is... One side is walking away from that compromise, even though Republicans in the Senate seem interested in moving forward. So,
David, I want to disagree slightly with what you just said, because I think there's two different groups here who are walking away. No question. Donald Trump said he wanted this issue for the election. And that has caused a lot of Republicans to say, like, look, if Donald Trump thinks he has a better chance of winning, if we don't fix immigration, then let's not fix immigration.
Right.
No question. But there's a second group which says we haven't even seen the details of this agreement. Nobody has.
Right.
And that right now, Democrats have the political crisis on their hands and on their watch. So they're willing to agree to nearly anything right now. Why are we saying, for instance, and this has been disputed, and I haven't seen the details of the deal as many U.S. senators haven't. But, you know, if, for instance, it allows 5,000 people to cross illegally a day, they're like, why are we letting anyone cross illegally a day? Why continue to let this happen at all rather than just shut it down and say, no, there's no more asylum claims if you cross the border illegally, as one example. So I think that's a separate group of Republicans, and maybe even be overlap between the two groups. But, you know, part of finding compromise legislation is agreeing that both sides are going to have to compromise, and it depends who has sort of the political will to continue to push what they need or what they want to agree to this.
But those Republicans, it sounds like, are the kind of lawmakers who might have been willing to continue the conversation and make the points that you're making right now, assuming that there was, you know, a desire on both sides to get to some sort of compromise. I mean, what you're bringing up sounds like kind of a smart policy conversation that in my dreams that could still be happening. And instead we had this kind of like elephant in the room who basically made it clear to his party that he wants to keep this issue burning and unresolved and that it's not even worth coming to the table anymore.
Well, don't be too, you know, look, they believe that Biden is so on the ropes on this issue when it comes to the 2024 campaign. And there is lots of evidence for that. Biden's approval rating is now at 38%. Pollsters think that that is driven largely by the crisis at the southern border and driven by really his own side, like, you know, sort of left of center folks and independents. It is political in the sense that they think Biden has no room to negotiate. He has no leverage to ask for a compromise. Democrats see this as a issue that will hurt them badly in the next election. So why shouldn't Republicans get everything that they want?
Well, because polling is now starting to show. I've just seen the first wave of polling. And I use wave loosely. I've seen a couple of polls come out in recent weeks that show that people are becoming increasingly frustrated with the narrative of Republicans walking away from a deal. And so this isn't a case where, yeah, both sides do need to compromise. Joe Biden is standing up to those elements of his base that are saying, oh my God, what do you mean you're going to shut the border down? That's antithetical to everything progressives stand for. You're being Trump-lite. He's standing up to them and saying, this is something we've got to do. I've yet to see the Republicans who are willing to stand up to the Republican base who are saying, you know, absolutely nothing. There's a compromise to be had here. And I think, as we talk about often, Republicans have a history of overplaying their hand by walking away from the negotiating table and saying the quiet part out loud, that it's because it's going to help Donald Trump. They're handing Democrats a huge political weapon to hit them with. And there's early polling shows that it has the potential to be very effective.
I think you're giving Biden a little too much credit here. Biden is not standing up to his left base at this point, or else he'd be doing all of the things at the border that he could be doing, all those Band-Aid things that I talked about. Instead, what you actually have is the reverse of the normal situation where members of Congress are riding the president's coattails. Members of Congress are actually more popular than Biden in a lot of these places. And so what you have is Biden hoping that his hands get tied by Congress, and many of these Democratic members of Congress knowing that the border is a huge, huge problem in their reelections. And so they also want to have their hands tied, so to speak, to be able to say they fixed the problem. You know, you're hearing very little from the far left about this because it's become politically untenable for the left.
Oh,
I mean, the far left elected.
I don't know. I hear a lot. I hear.
Where are the Democratic members of the Senate freaking out about this? I don't see them. In fact, they're all saying they'd vote for this. Biden's saying he'd sign it, and they haven't even seen it. They're saying they'd sign it.
I think these. Right. And you've got people who haven't even seen it saying that they want to that this is dead on arrival.
Well, I want to ask you something about something you said, Sarah, and also that's related to what we heard from that Democratic Party chair in Texas. I think there are Democrats. I don't want to assume I know what her motivations are, but as you know, Mo, I think there are a lot of Democrats who are worried that things like razor wire and talk of invasion, you know, has racist undertones. And I guess, Sarah, my question, like you very often bring up the cartels, how much money they're making and they need to be dealt with. Is there a way for President Biden or anyone to specifically deal with the cartels without criminalizing and potentially othering people who are coming to the United States with hope of a better life?
Here's the problem, David. When you set up a system where you have a legal immigration system, but it's also horribly broken. You'll have to wait a really, really long time and you may not get in. Or you can just come to the border, and as long as you cross and say you have a credible fear of returning to your home country, whether that asylum claim is then found credible in the end or not, the vast majority, I think 85%, are actually not in the end. But in the meantime, you've gotten 5 years in the United States. As long as that's the system you have set up, why would anyone wait in line at that point? And so you're incentivizing the illegal immigration. That's the system that we have right now. The asylum system, such it is, where you can't detain people, you parole them into the country, regardless of what's going to happen to their asylum claim eventually. And then 5 years down the road, when you say, well, you don't get asylum, that person disappears. Then,
but can't you go after the cartel somehow specifically?
But the cartels have grown up because of the demand. There was illegal immigration long before there were cartels. There were just sort of individual coyotes running this when it was mostly Mexican nationals coming across the border. Then we had the Northern Triangle countries. Now we have Venezuela. I mean, we're playing whack-a-mole if we think we're going to solve this by helping other countries' economies. Our economy will always be stronger. Solving it by stopping the cartels. The cartels are responding to demand to get here.
Right.
They're just making it easier for people.
Right. But the demand is there because of deteriorating conditions in their home countries. The demand is there because their economies are crumbling.
That's right. So we keep helping those countries. We helped the Northern Triangle. We pumped billions into those countries. We helped them. And then it became Venezuela. So we're going to stop. We're going to do Mexico. Then we're going to do all the Northern Triangle countries. Then we're going to do Venezuela. Then we'll be some other country. And our economy is still going to be stronger.
There is no singular solution on this. We have to keep focusing on the Northern Triangle.
There is.
There isn't. We have to
have a border.
If we think
no other country has this problem except us.
Not every country has an influx of people wanting to come to this country the way ours does. If we seal the border, if we just, 100% and say nobody is allowed to cross this border, they're going to find ways around it because that's what people do. I'm not saying we don't seal it. I think there's
not a million a year.
There are multiple things that need to be done. One, we have to deal with the root cause. We have to keep trying to change the conditions in these home countries so that people do not have as much reason to flee their home countries and leave their families behind. Number two, we have to deal with the cartels and those who are criminally bringing people in. And number three, we have to deal with the border and have real border security. None of those things are mutually exclusive. Throwing up razor wire is a stunt. It's not going to keep people out. Talking about an invasion is just going to stir things, especially when you say, oh my goodness, have you seen this invasion coming? Let's deal with it after the election. I mean, in what world is that a rational argument, right? The stunts that we are seeing at the border, as well as the naivete that that there is no problem at the border, both of those are a disservice to this really important issue. We have to figure out in all of the above. There's just no political will to do it.
I mean, look, the concertina wire, you can call it a stunt. It is a stunt, but it has worked. Like, the numbers literally have dropped. And, the last thing that was called a stunt was when Abbott started busing people who wanted to go to Chicago, New York, et cetera. And that's turned out to have a huge effect on the leverage that has been brought to this Senate negotiation in the first place, because now all of a sudden these blue states that claim to be sanctuary cities are actually having to live with the policies that they said they were, sort of like the NIMBY part, right? It's all fun and games to say you're a sanctuary city when you don't have any migrants coming, and calling Texas racist when they've been the one dealing with a million people a year coming over.
Last word, Bo.
Look, let's just, for argument's sake, say that there is a border-only solution to our immigration problem, which I'm going to continue to reject. Then fund more border agents. Don't walk away from that proposal, as the Republicans did.
Correct.
Then deal with this compromise bill that is on the table now. Don't call it an invasion and then say you'll deal with it after the election once you take charge. That's not the right answer to this either, right? We've got to stop walking away from efforts to fund the technology that will be more effective than razor wire and border walls that will actually help enable the Border Patrol to do their job more effectively. Republicans walked away from that too. Now, a lot of this is stunts. A lot of this is stunts because, as you and I have agreed a million times on this show, there is more political incentive to not solve this problem than there is to actually solve it.
Yes.
And we are seeing that very much happening right now.
All right, we got to stop there. But I think the take home for me, one of many, is that the system needs to be reformed, and it has to come from Congress, and there's been no political will to actually.
Absolutely.
100%.
And so I wish the conversation that we just had would be taking place more and more on Capitol Hill with a desire to find real solutions, and that's not happening. And you both know that I quaintly believe that maybe we'll get back there someday. Okay, we're going to move on, and Sarah Moe, we're going to be back swiftly here on Left, Right, and Center. We are back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah Isger and Moe Lathy are here on the list of things I never expected but probably should have is Taylor Swift being front and center in the 2024 presidential race. This was Caroline Leavitt, who is Donald Trump's national campaign press secretary on The Benny Show. As you'll hear, she is citing incredibly solid sources to report that Taylor Swift is about to endorse President Biden.
That's the word on the street. The Democrats are pushing for it. They're calling it their Hail Mary pass to drag Biden over the finish line. Here's the deal. I don't think people are going to take advice from someone who flies around on a private jet, has private security, when they're paying thousands of dollars more just to live. That might not be a lot of money for Taylor Swift. She may not feel the impact of Bidenomics, but millions of people across this country are. She should stick to writing songs. And by the way, Benny, this woman has made a career off of writing songs about picking the wrong guy. We should not trust her to pick the wrong guy in this presidential election.
Word on the street. That's her source. Okay. Well, yes, the New York Times did report that a Swift endorsement is on the Biden campaign's wish list. That alone has sent Trump-leaning media into a frenzy. A frenzy, we should say, that they appeared to welcome.
Why would someone as popular as she is alienate? And I'm not saying, you know, it's going to be, yeah, people are going to hate her, but why alienate your fans, the Swifties?
If you need Taylor Swift to save your presidency, do you have a presidency? That's a deep thought.
We both said that we were cheering for the opposite team, the Ravens, to beat out the Chiefs just because we have had enough of Taylor Swift for now. But here's the facts. Chiefs are going to the Super Bowl, and now there's an online plea circulating that is begging people to become Niners fans for the next 2 weeks, just so it doesn't raise Travis Kelce, a.k.a. Mr. Pfizer's star power, along with, of course, Taylor Swift, because it is so scary. There was a recent poll. One-fifth of Taylor Swift fans said they would back whichever candidate that she endorsed. Just please don't believe everything Taylor Swift says. We're all begging you.
They're elevating her to an idol, idolatry. This is a little bit what idolatry, I think, looks like. And you're not supposed to do that. In fact, if you look it up in the Bible, it's a sin.
All right, those were clips there from Newsmax and from Fox News. This non-existent endorsement is flustering conservative media, but not just conservative media, but possibly the Republican nominee as well. The reports this week that Donald Trump's camp is apparently ready to declare holy war on Taylor Swift in the event that she endorses Biden. Swift, as you might have heard, is dating Kansas City Chiefs star and vaccine advocate Travis Kelce. And the Kansas City Chiefs appearance in the upcoming Super Bowl has led to even conspiracy theories about the NFL and Biden working together to boost Biden's chances through the couple's reputation. I'm exhausted, and I just want to start by saying there's not an endorsement. How did this happen? Why are we even talking about this? What's going on?
Okay. A few things here. One, Taylor Swift endorsed Joe Biden in 2020. So it's not
true.
Outside the realm of possibility to think, maybe even assume, that she'll endorse him in 2024.
Okay.
I think the question is, it wasn't a very big deal in 2020. Why is it suddenly the apocalypse in 2024? And why then does it matter whether Travis Kelce wins the Super Bowl? Like, she already endorsed him in 2020. So, okay. I have a few theories on this.
Good. Bring it. Bring it.
One, and I'm going to crib this a little from Eric Erickson, for those who are familiar with him. He's a conservative pundit type. He points out pretty persuasively in my book that a lot of these right-wing people talking about this are grifters. And this is a way for them to glom on to something else happening in the news to make themselves relevant. Right. So Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift are the most famous couple in the world right now. Taylor Swift probably is the most famous woman in the world right now. And so there's this thing in the news that isn't Donald Trump.
But isn't that Donald Trump is doing too? Like, I want to glom on to. Yeah, that's what you're saying.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you're not just the media people, but Trump too. Yeah.
Well, Trump hasn't actually said anything about Taylor Swift yet. So this is really just these media, like right wing online MAGA folks who I think absolutely see this as a chance for them to inject themselves into this conversation, get a lot of clicks. They don't care if it helps Donald Trump, hurts him. They don't care if it is rational. As long as we're engaging with it, they're getting what they need, which is relevance.
Right.
Now, so in 2020, she endorsed Joe Biden and it didn't hurt her brand at all. She didn't lose her right-wing fans because conservatives, Republicans, they would not be able to consume any, you know, pop culture whatsoever if that were a deal breaker for them. So they're pretty used to that. What I think could be different this time around, if Donald Trump engages on this, he could actually drive down Taylor Swift's favorables. We've seen him do it with people all the time who are otherwise sort of popular celebrities. That puts them in the center of a culture war. That's different than just endorsing Joe Biden in 2020. So I think that is, I mean, it's like exhausting. I'm exhausted ahead of time, but I think it's a real possibility. And it will make Taylor Swift's endorsement less valuable. But look, I don't think Joe Biden won the election in 2020 because of Taylor Swift. And that poll that they referenced actually asked people, would you be more likely to vote for a candidate that Taylor Swift endorsed? And 20% said yes. But that wasn't really taking into account a candidate that you already know. You know, they already know Biden. They already know Trump. Yeah, if there's two candidates and they don't know either one, and then Taylor Swift is like, I like Joe. Yeah, maybe that could have a 20% effect. Maybe.
Mo, are you enjoying all this?
My favorite clip in that montage you played at the top of the segment was the last one, or one of the last ones, with the guy. I think if I recall, he was from Newsmax, who was making the biblical reference to idolatry. And this is what idolatry looks like.
Yeah.
I mean,
hot kettle.
Yeah, exactly. Now do Trump, right?
No, that was my first thought too. It's like when we talk about idolatry in our country today, like who is the one person we should be thinking about? Yeah.
Look, you know, this isn't, I think, just, you know, in the right-wing fringe ecosystem. This is how like crazy stuff and conspiracies take root. It starts there. And I couldn't agree with Sarah more that these are people who are struggling to find relevance, and this is how they do it. I mean, like the Benny Show. I mean, come on. But it's being picked up on Fox News, and it's being played on segments on Fox News throughout the day and the evening, Fox News being the highest rated cable news station in America. And also where Donald Trump gets a lot of his information. So now when you've got a huge segment of the population hearing this all day, throughout the day, on their most trusted news source, and Donald Trump is hearing it, we know from history, from experience, that that is the best way to suck him into a fight.
Right.
He's being goaded by these far right-wing crackpots that Sarah's talking about. They're goading him into this at some point, I think. And it'll be subtle and it'll be whatever. He'll stand on the stage and say, you know, they say Taylor Swift may vote for Joe Biden. You know, I'm more popular than she. You know, I mean, it'll be something silly like that. But it's true. Now, what I think the thing that Sarah said that is the most interesting to me, and I think she's 100% right on, is that this isn't about Taylor Swift endorsing Joe Biden. This is just the latest volley in a culture war by a MAGA world that is driven not by populism, but by paranoiaism, if that's a thing, right? The political ideology of MAGA world, not of Republicans, not of conservatives, but of MAGA world specifically, is paranoia and an anti-elitism. And so now you have this woman who is an elite entertainer worth $1 billion with out there on a stage. And the notion that she may try to insert herself, her voice into our politics is enough. It's enough to stir this up and to say, see, this is yet another example of us versus them, yet another example of how they're trying to keep us down.
Well, that is the saddest part of all this to me. I remember the WNYC had a great podcast a few years ago about Dolly Parton and her ability to bring people from every political walk of life together at a concert and feel like, you know, there was hope for America in some way. I mean, hardcore progressives, hardcore conservatives, like everybody. And, you know, I think when I looked at you know, friends and others and looked at images from Taylor Swift concerts on the Eras tour, like there was a real sort of unifying thing. It didn't matter who you were, what you thought or what your politics were. You know, her music was unifying. And I know some people might be nauseated when they hear me saying this, but I really believe that. And this has the potential to undermine all of that if she's cast as some sort of elitist who flies private jets and can't connect with you. I just hope she makes it to the Super Bowl from Japan, where she has that concert. I just hope she makes it to the Super Bowl, because that's really important.
Anyway. I'm glad you're rooting for young love, David.
Yes, I am.
I'm not even a fan of hers. And I'm totally outraged by this.
We're all going to sit and listen to Taylor sometime and make you a fan, Mo. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Before we go, it is time for our rants and raves. Mo, you want to kick us off?
Really interesting story out of the Oregon Supreme Court this week, which ruled that a group of Republican lawmakers who had boycotted a legislative session for 6 weeks were no longer eligible to run for re-election. And I just found this story so fascinating, because this is a tactic that we've seen in a number of places over the years. We've seen this in Texas with Democrats a few years back, where they all left town rather than sit for a legislative session in order to try to block action on some legislation. And now we've seen it 3 out of the last 4 years amongst Republicans in Oregon. As a result of these boycotts, Oregon voters passed a constitutional amendment that said, if you're an elected official who has more than 10 unexcused absences, you may not run for re-election. And so the Secretary of State deemed a number of the Republican legislators, 10 of them, I believe, ineligible to run for re-election. They sued. It went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said the new constitutional amendment is pretty clear. You can't do it. There are going to be times when if that becomes the standard, if that would upset me, because I've seen some Democrats use this to good effect on issues I care about. But maybe this tactic maybe people have overplayed their hand using this tactic. Voters are sending a clear message. Show up to work and do your jobs.
Do your job. Sarah, that wasn't directed at you. I was just sort of putting emphasis on an exclamation point on Mo's.
Right. Yeah. But it applies.
Yeah, it does. Sarah, your rant or rave.
Today, I will do an ode to cats. My cat is about to turn 17 years old in just a couple weeks. And I have a friend who, she wants a dog, but she doesn't really have the lifestyle amenable to a dog. And she was asking me, should I get a cat? I was like, you know, in most things, you shouldn't compromise and not get the thing you really want. Just like wait. Except when it comes to cats. Cats are just wonderful in all situations, especially the time where you can't really get a dog. They're incredibly low maintenance, but don't get a kitten. Kittens are not low maintenance. Kittens are nocturnal. But cats, go get a rescue cat that's like a year old. You know, you put out food for them. They snuggle with you on their own terms. They're kind of like throw pillows that eat occasionally. And they're just incredible companions. And as someone who spent so much time on the campaign trail and traveling. Man, I've had Franny since my second year in law school, when the hiring partner at the law firm I was working at found four kittens. I took two and she took two. They have, well, her brother died last year, but they have lived in like half a dozen states, a gazillion cities. They've been everywhere. They hate the car. They're homebody kittens now and just loving their lives.
Well, shout out to Franny. And you should do a PSA with the Buffalo Bills kicker who missed that field goal in the playoffs, who loves kittens as well and encourages getting rescue kittens. Well, I can't top cats and rescue kittens, so we're gonna stop there. That is Left, Right, and Center. I want to thank the amazing team who puts the show together each and every week. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green, and our executive producer is Arnie Seipel, and the show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Come back next week, and we'll do more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.